other piece to the melody. All right, wonderful to be with you all again. Good to see you. So yesterday we started in on the letter bet, and bet is an interesting kind of contrast to Aleph, because with our kavanah, with our Aleph kavanah, the idea was focusing on the aspect of presence, the aspect of awareness that is openness. Just putting on my do not disturb here. It doesn't beep. Okay. And we also talked about how really this openness is the ground of our being, but we tend not to live at that level unless we intentionally practice that. We tend instead to live at the level of the duality of feeling myself and the universe as two different things. And so Bet is going to use that fact and bring the openness of presence of Aleph into our dualistic experience. There are some spiritual teachers that I've heard, definitely not Jewish ones, but certain non-dual teachers that I've heard, because I like to check out as many as I can and see what folks are doing. And there's a certain approach that some teachers have, which is to radically affirm the position of the openness as the door opens. Hello. Oh, you left something?
I don't know if it's here.
Okay.
People could have an eye out for it.
Oh, okay.
An embroidered pin in lavender turquoise with tools on it.
Okay.
Little Ellie loves tools. And that's
hey, why don't you put a note on the one?
I did. It's already up.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you. Just when you leave, just have an eye out. There's
yeah.
No big, with a pin on the back, Theodore Elston. Sorry, it looks like it's on in here.
Yeah. No problem. So it is an approach to radically take the position of the openness, to affirm that what is what is. That's basically the position of the Aleph, is we're constantly relaxing ourselves out of the dualistic mind, out of the dualistic perspective of me and the rest of it, out of good and bad. Right, and just saying, bringing our mind to connect with the perception of what is. So it's not. So it's moving us beyond the ordinary judging tendency of the mind. And I'm not just talking about being judgmental, like judging other people. It's much, much more fundamental than that. It's that in order to navigate the world, we're constantly making little judgments. So, again, it's not to stop that, because if we were to stop that, we'd become non-functional, which, by the way, is something that happens sometimes to people when they go really deep into this kind of practice. And in my experience, it's not something to fear, because it's just a temporary thing. It actually happened to me for about a week at one point in the late 90s. And then an adjustment happens in the nervous system. I read a story about an Indian teacher to whom it happened for almost a year. And then he snapped out of it, and then he became a teacher. But before that, he was like in this state. So, oh, just meaning that he just couldn't really do normal, mundane things. Like, no, not lethargy at all, no. Lethargy means like you don't want to do stuff. This is it can happen to some people that the mind is simply not able to function in the mundane way anymore. It's like actually a good example of it. You can watch this YouTube video of a woman who is a brain scientist. And she had, you know about what I'm talking about? No?
I'm really curious.
Oh, okay, yeah, check this out. And I apologize, I don't remember her name, but I bet if you Google it, like brains, she had a stroke. And the stroke led to an extreme presence. Yeah, so what happened is one side of her brain went out. So I believe it's the left side that goes out. The left side is responsible for calculating, judging, figuring out, and so on. Also memory, context, you know, what is my name? What do I do in this world? All that stuff went out. And so...
like ego death, kind of.
Yeah, well, it was absolutely an ego death. And... she was not a meditator. She really had no prior interest in spirituality. But what happened is she found herself simply in the present moment without the ability to be anywhere else. So she really didn't know what her name was. She didn't know how to do things. And the experience of whatever was going on in the moment, like right now, for example, there's some fluorescent lights. We have the shapes and texture and color of the room, maybe each other sitting here, the sounds. That's all that would be there. Now, I shouldn't say all completely, because she said that there was a little bit of awareness that something was missing, you know, that she knew she used to be able to do things. It wasn't like she was just, you know, just no thought at all. There was a little bit of thought, and there was the sense that she couldn't access any of that stuff. And there was a sense of extreme palpable bliss and spaciousness, because there was no emotional burden, because all emotional burden comes from our mind holding a certain context that we resist. We know what's going on and we don't like it, or some aspects of it we don't like. Some aspects of it are burdensome. So when we practice meditation and presence, and when you go really deeply into it, we're doing the same thing, except we're not trying to stifle or damage in any way the left brain functioning. We're just bringing our sense of identity, our sense of who we are, into the present side, which is a more fundamental aspect of our experience. It's the part that's always there, even in deep sleep. For example, if we weren't aware when we were in deep sleep, then someone couldn't come over and wake us up, because there needs to be awareness there to be able to feel someone is shaking you. Like that Ernie and Bert episode where Ernie comes and pokes Bert, poke, 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 and wakes him up in order to tell him that it's time for his nap. Anyway. Getting back to the point, there are teachers that will radically affirm that point of view, the presence point of view. And when you start to talk in the third person about the practice, like, for example, you ask a person like that, a teacher like that, well, okay, what should I do? How should I meditate? Then all they'll say is, there is no you to decide what you want to do, how to meditate. So they're just deconstructing your language right as you go along in order to get you into that fundamental place of awareness. They're not going to answer questions in a third person as if there's me and there's you and then there's the third thing, the practice that we're talking about. No, they're going to just deny that and shuttle you into the present. So that's good. But since Judaism is really a communal kind of householder tradition, it's not a monastic, radical, non-dual tradition, though it contains that non-dual element within it. I find the Hebrew letters paradigm and the paradigm that's expressed in Kabbalah through Tree of Life and so on to be much more holistic. And the idea being that the truth that's accessible through the non-dual point of view, which is to say the Aleph point of view, is then to be expressed in the ordinariness of life. That's also one of the main thrusts of Hasidism as well, and what Martin Buber kind of affirmed is like the gift of Hasidism to the world. It's not that Hasidism is the only tradition that says this. Many traditions say it, but Hasidism said it in such a beautiful way and has so many beautiful examples of this idea of sanctification of the ordinary. Ritual Judaism says there's ordinary life and then there's the mitzvot. Then the mitzvot are the special things. Those are the holy things. Hasidism comes along and says, yes, it doesn't deny that. The mitzvot are very special. It's still the central thing, but the purpose of the mitzvot is not just themselves. The purpose of it is to train us to be able to approach our actions, approach the moment with a sense of, with the holiness of the midot, meaning with reverence, with gratitude, with surrender, with humility, like all those qualities that flow from presence, and then to use our training with the mitzvot to bring that into all of life, into all of the mundanity, into picking up the toothbrush. You know, just every moment that's done with this sense of presence. And of course, the tendency with all religious traditions. It's like the great tragedy of religion is that it tends to dualize. It tends to do the opposite of that. It tends to say, here's a special holy thing, and then the rest of life is just crap. And we just have to get through it, and that's where all the hypocrisy comes from. People are so reverent, but then they act like jerks. So that's our task, is to be able to really go to the root of what it's talking about, of the opportunity of the tradition, to whatever degree that we're practicing it, to go to the root of it, which is this presence piece. And Bet is going to help us in that, I think. So yesterday, we looked at the beginning of Bereshit. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. And we read that together, the Elohim creating the heavens and the earth and so on. And this is the one day. So I want to take you through a little Torah, which is a little piece of Kabbalah word play that is brought again by the Yitzhak Ginsburg book. And it's on the word Bereshit itself. So if we look at the word Bereshit, we take the prefix. So what's the prefix in that word Bereshit? B. That's right. It's just the one letter, Bet, right? And then we take the what are called the servant letters, the letters at the end that put it in the construct form, which means it's kind of like in English saying the word of. Like if we translate the Bereshit, it would really be in the beginning of. The eat at the end is the of. Okay, so those are the letters Yud and Tav, right. So what happens if we take the beginning, the prefix, and the servant letters at the end, the Bet, and the Yud and the Tav, and put them together? We get?
Bayit.
Bayit, right, Bayit, or Beit, the letter, name of the letter itself, which means house. Now, let's go into the middle of the word, the Resh Shin. What is that? Actually, it's the Resh Aleph Shin. What does that make, the Resh Aleph Shin?
Rosh,
right, Rosh, which means head, but it doesn't only mean head, because head is a basic, it's an idiom, right, in the Hebrew language, that a Rosh is also the head of something, and it's also Resh, means the beginning of something, so it's like the something that's primary. In a school, there's the Rosh is the head of the school. So what do we have here in the picture of that word Bereshit? We have the Rosh is in the Bayit. You see that? The Rosh is in the Bayit. So we have this kind of symbolism in the very word Bereshit of this coming together of two different things, that there's a container, a vessel, that's the Bayit, and then something, the Rosh, that means the one who is has some kind of sovereignty, some control over things, not control in a negative sense, but responsibility, who's holding the whole. The Rosh is in the Bayit. And this is an expression of an idea that actually comes from a Midrash, which says that the purpose of creation, you know, if you want to know the meaning of why does the universe exist in the first place, so there's a Midrash that expresses the purpose of creation is that the Rosh should be in the Bayit, meaning that the divine wants to have a home, wants to have a place, a location. And so then that is a way that all of our spiritual practice has a certain meaning, that we're doing the practice in order to create a home for the divine. Yeah.
Like the Taoist idea that like the Tao is older than God because it's not really God if it's just God by God's self.
Right.
Separation and that extra thing that isn't completely God, mm-hmm. is what makes God tangible. Same thing with like if there's only dark.
Right.
Dark. It's just
right, Right.
Yeah.
Right, there's no contrast there.
Right. So that is like symbolic of that contrast?
Yeah. I mean, and in this particular teaching, it's actually giving us a direction and a meaning of what we're doing in our lives. Like we're here in this world, we're doing stuff all the time, but what's the ultimate purpose of what we're doing is that there's this ultimate reality, which we can call, in our experience, is the ground of our experience, the awareness, right? The awareness that we are. But we have to make a certain type of effort in order to bring that awareness into full connection with the container for the awareness, into our bodies. The main thing is into our bodies, right? Making the body into a temple. But then also, how is that expressed externally? And we're going to get to that in a minute, how the primary way that this can be expressed. So why don't we go to the texts now and move on to the second text, which is the ritual embodiment of the same principle, this little thing that comes from Shemot. I'm wondering if anybody can read that. Yeah. And what does it mean in English?
They shall make for me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell within them.
Mm-hmm. Ve'asuli, asuli mikdash, ve'shachanti betocham, ve'asuli, asuli mikdash, ve'shachanti. Have nice voices. Wonderful little verse, which is a way of summing up again the same principle, a way of directing our kavanah for what we're doing here in all of our actions. So there's an interesting construction in this verse. Does anybody notice anything that's weird about the way this verse is said? You can see it also in the English translation.
Shall make for me a sanctuary.
Okay. Is that, what would be weird about that?
Instead of me.
Make a sanctuary for me. Me,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Right, okay.
All
right, yeah. Well, let's look at, what about the second half of it?
Well, that God's dwelling with the people, not in the sanctuary.
Right, exactly. It's weird. It should say, it's kind of like in the meditation we do, na'aseh v'nishma. It shouldn't say that. It should say nishma v'na'aseh. Whenever the Hebrew does these weird things, there are these little hints that are embedded in the text. They shall make for me a sanctuary, v'shechanti betocham, it should be betocho, and I will dwell in it. But no, I will dwell in them.
So is this like the immanent God, like kind of hearing that story about, like, you know, the low fog traveling through the desert with the Jewish people or whatever?
I don't know about the low fog.
I'm probably not using the correct terminology.
Uh-huh.
But to me, that feels more like an immanent.
Yes, absolutely. In the Torah, it's expressed really in the way the whole narrative unfolds is that the divine presence, the Shekhinah, is physically manifested, you know, when they build the Mishkan, it comes in, there's this cloud that descends on the actual Mishkan, which is this
cloud
portable.
Not
oh, yeah, okay, so that's what you were talking about. Yeah, so it comes down. And then before that, also, there's this pillar of cloud or a pillar of fire. So pictorially, this idea that the divine is dwelling with us is expressed in the text. But in our actual experience, this is all pointing to a practice that we can do right now, which is to allow our presence to be in the body, to let our bodies be a mishkan. Now, in that sense, the actual mishkan that it's talking, or in this, it calls it a mikdash, which comes from kadosh. It's a holy place, okay? This is a really good reminder about any kind of spiritual practices we do, whether we're lighting a Shabbat candle or we're saying some prayers or whatever, blowing a shofar, whatever it is, that the ritual action is pointing to an inner reality and an inner practice of v'shachanti b'tocham, that our consciousness comes into our bodies. So again, this is an aspect of presence that simply adds to and deepens and complements the Aleph. The Aleph is, here I am, hineni, I'm open to be with whatever is, and there's just a oneness of what is. Then with Bet, we say, okay, so now that I have this attitude, what do I do? This is also mirrored in the integral Jewish meditation practice that we did when we put left hand on the belly and bring awareness in the body. So now that we have this attitude of being completely just open to what is, we intensify awareness into our physical bodies. And that helps us to make that shift of this miracle of consciousness to be fully in touch, fully connected to reality, as opposed to what it does by default, which is spin off into ultimately self-centered, self-motivated thought patterns. Now, when I say that, it doesn't mean that we're arrogant. It just means that the motive is like, there's a way in which we are seeking something through our thinking. There's a sense, perhaps, of incompleteness, of not connectedness, of not fullness, and we're seeking something with our thinking. This is a reversal of that. We're noticing, oh, there's the mind going into thinking, seeking something. Instead, let me use that same energy, that same mind energy, instead of using it for thinking, let me use it to connect with the body. V'shechanti b'tocham. Very, very profound shift. And then we can tap into what that neuroscientist who had the stroke tapped into by accident without losing our thinking mind. We can refer to it when we need to, but we can actually live in this gift, this spaciousness, this freedom is already ours, but we have to take it. It doesn't just come by accident unless we have a stroke. Okay, so there's another little piece of Kabbalah that Rabbi Ginsburg brings, which is that the word Rosh, remember the Rosh is in the Bayit in Bereshit? If we turn, what are the letters for Rosh again?
Rosh.
Yeah, so now what happens if we take the Aleph and we put it in the beginning and we put the Shin in the middle and we put the Resh at the end?
Asher
or Ashir or Osher, which is basically the word that begins Ashrei. Ashrei Yoshvei Ve'Techa. Again, Ashrei, happy are the ones, Yoshvei Ve'Techa, who dwell in the house. The hint here is we have it in both places. In the Ashrei, it's saying that if you want happiness, and it's not just happiness, because Sameach, right, is happiness. That's more of a kind of the emotion of happy. But Ashrei really is also connected to Osher, which is wealth. And the idea is that there's a sense of fullness, of completeness. And there's a natural, a goodness that is inherent in that. So when the Rosh is in the Bayit, when our awareness is in our bodies and not generating a secondary world in the mind of thought, then that is also the portal to being Ashrei as well. Okay. All right, so let's look at one more. Let's look at one more text. Vayar elav Hashem. Did you want to read?
Sure.
Okay.
Vayar elav Adonai ve'elone mamre v'hu yoshev petach ha'ohel kechom hayom.
Mm-hmm. In the English?
The divine appeared to him by the terebinths of Mamre, who was sitting at the entrance of the tent of the Degurot.
By the way, the he is talking about, does anybody know this story? Do you know what we're talking about?
Abraham,
right. This is in Bereshit. Abraham is on a hot day like this, sitting in the tent, sitting in the entrance of the tent, like on the porch. Okay, let's keep going.
Vayisa enav, vayar behine shlosha anashim netzavim alav, vayar vayaratz likratam mipetach ha'ohel, vayishtachu arza. Looking up, he saw three men standing near him. As soon as he saw them, he ran from the entrance of the tent to greet them and bowed to the ground. Vayomer Adonai, Im na matzatichen be'enecha, al na ta'avor me'al abdecha. He said, "My lords, if it pleases you, do not go on past your servant." Vayikach na me'at ma'im v'rachatzu rad lechem v'hishanu tachat ha'etz. Let a little water be brought, bathe your feet, and recline under the tree. Ve'akach fat lechem ve'sa'adu libchem achar ta'avoru ki alken avartem al avarechem vayomru ken ta'asek asher divarta. And let me fetch a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves, then go on, seeing that you have come your servant's way. They replied, "Do as you have said." Vayimaher Abraham ha-ohela el Sarah vayomer mahari shalosh si'im kemach soled lushe ve-va-asi ugot. Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, "Quick, three measures of choice flour. Please knead and make cakes." Ve-el ha-bakar ratz Abraham vayikach ben bakar Rach v'tov, vayiten el hana'ar, vayimaher la'asot oto. Then Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf tender and choice, and gave it to the servant boy who hastened to prepare it. Vayikach chema v'chalav uvein ha'bakar asher asav vayiten lifnechem v'hu omed alehem tachat ha'etz vayom. He took curds of milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them, and he waited on them under the trees as they ate.
Okay, very good. Thank you for reading all that in Hebrew and English. A little piece that really has nothing to do with what we're talking about that's interesting in this passage. Do you notice anything funny about the kashrut of what's going on here? Yes, but so how did? But what's funny about it in its relation to the kashrut that we practice?
The curds and the milk and the calf.
Yeah, yeah. So does anybody know about this and how it relates to kashrut nowadays?
You don't mix milk and meat.
Right.
But
right.
You don't mix milk and meat because it says don't cook a calf in its mother's milk.
Right.
Don't nourish it with don't cook it in what's supposed to be nourishing it.
Right. Now, if you look on this, You know, there's a rabbinic idea that our ancestor, the patriarchs and matriarchs, kept all these rules. And this is a blatant display of not keeping the rules. It's saying he's serving meat and milk.
You underestimate the creativity.
Yeah.
Because they actually use this to prove
yes.
that Abraham kept.
Thank you. That's what I was getting to. So tell us about that.
It says milk and meat. But it says milk and meat.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, look, he served them the milk, and then a little later he served them the meat. So the
right.
proof that he separated dairy from meat.
Well, not only that, not only proof, but it actually becomes the halakha that we, the standard rabbinic practice is that you can eat milk and then meat. You can eat meat and then milk. So this is actually the text from which that rabbinic halakha about the order of eating meat and milk comes from. So it's a little aside, a little Jewish,
so
not exactly trivia, but.
So period between the ice cream and your steak.
So
yeah.
if you have.
So the point is that the end means that it was later.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's true. The standard practice nowadays is that if you want to have some ice cream and then some steak, that would be fine. But not to have the steak and then the ice cream, then you have to wait a while first. Okay, this is not on the topic, but I just wanted to point it out. So you may know that Avraham and Sarah are considered the archetypes of hospitality. In Kabbalah, they represent chesed, which is loving kindness. Okay, so this is the proof text for that. This is the root of where that idea comes from. Is that there's a midrash that says Avraham was sitting in the heat of the day, kachom hayom, because he had, in the passages right before, he had performed circumcision on himself, so he was in great pain. And so the fact that he got up from his pain and ran out to the visitors is proof of his extreme hospitality, that he was able to do that even though he was in a lot of pain. Another interesting thing is that in the typical image of hospitality, we tend to think of hospitality as inviting people into our homes, right? Hachnasat orchim. But he doesn't exactly do that here. He runs out of his home and greets them, and then he says, recline under the tree. And then he goes into his home and only to ask Sarah to, you know, make some food, and then they bring the food out and they bring it to the guests. So there's a hint in here also about the inside and the outside, this duality of bet and particularly the practice of being in our bodies, of bringing awareness in our bodies, which is that it's through our connection with our bodies that we can tap into the inner nourishment that's needed in order to be outward to other people. Did you ever feel like, I just can't deal with other people, or I just feel too annoyed, I can't like relate with other people and be nice? Okay, so that means that we need some nourishment. We need to be by ourselves. We need to take some space. But you won't need to take as much space if, as you move through your day, you have more of your awareness really really rooted in your own body. It's as if you have, part of you is in the tent of Abraham and Sarah, getting that morsel of bread and the water and the calf and the curds and so on. And the other half of you is able to run out and to be, you know, to greet people. As it says in Pirkei Avot, you know, what does it say? Kol ha'adam besever panim yafot. Greet every person with a joyful face. Take that nourishment that you get from the inside and give it to the outside. So this is what we're doing, is we're taking now this inner practice and talking about the expression of it in the flow of life. Okay. Another hint here in the teaching is that these guys who came by were wanderers. He didn't know them, right? It's one thing to reach out to our friends and invite them into our house. It's another thing to invite someone in who is dirty and dusty and wandering and we don't know who they are and so on. Now, that may or may not apply to our situations in real life, literally, of inviting people into our house, but the implication here is actually hinting back to that Aleph attitude of actively welcoming that which is not pleasant. So there's a story of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. Have anybody heard of him? Levi Yitzchak. So the story goes that he was traveling and he came to a town. He often traveled and taught in different places. He came to a town and he went right to a very wealthy man's house, his little mansion in the little village. And he knocks on the door and he says, "Hello, I'm wondering if I can stay with you for Shabbos." And the wealthy man was greedy. He was miserly. He said, "Get out of here. I don't take in vagrants." And he says, "Please, you know, I'm traveling. It would be really nice if you'd let me stay here." He says, "Why don't you stay in the inn?" He says, "I can't. I don't have the means to stay in the inn." "Okay, so why don't you go around the corner and stay with the school teacher? He likes to take in vagrants." "Okay." So he goes around the corner and he goes to the school teacher, and the school teacher has great, abundant hospitality, invites him in, and he stays with him. But on his way there, some people noticed, who recognized Levi Yitzchak. You know, this is before internet, so it's like just in the mind, like people had to know who he was. So someone noticed and started spreading it around the town. Levi Yitzchak is in our town. And as the rumor grew and grew, a crowd started gathering around the school teacher's house. And soon people started coming in and they're knocking at the door. "Can we see Levi Yitzchak? Can we talk to him?" And among those people was the miserly rich guy. So Levi Yitzchak comes out, and immediately the miser starts getting people out of his way and makes his way to the front and says, "Rabbi, Rabbi, forgive me. I didn't know it was you. Please come stay with me. All of the great rebbes must stay with me when they come to town." And Levi Yitzchak said, "Why is it in Bereshit that such a big deal is made about Avraham and Sarah having hospitality just because they invited in those angels?" Those men, by the way, were angels. "When Lot in Sodom did the same exact thing, right? The angels went down to Lot and he invited them in also and made them food, matzahs and so on. Same exact thing. So why is no big deal made about Lot?" And he said, "Because it says, when they went down to see Lot, it says in the Torah that the angels went down toward Sodom. But when Abraham raised his eyes and saw them, it said, three men were standing over him. Lot saw something amazing. These angels were coming. Let me invite them in. But Abraham just saw poor, dusty wayfarers." So, cute story, but it's pointing to looking at our own reactivity that we have toward others. And not just others in the hospitality sense, but really in terms of every experience that arises. When an experience comes that's a dusty wayfarer, do we reject it? Do we say, "Oh, I don't want to feel that. I don't want to see that. I don't want that to be whatever," or do we welcome it? Do we welcome it into the tent or into our field of experience? So using the metaphor, the tent, the temple, the house, the bayit is the body, is our physical body. And the open field of awareness is both within the body and beyond the body. And so this is the Aleph and the Bet within the Aleph. So why don't we come to practice it, unless anybody has any comments or questions. Yeah.
Well, I've been practicing this a little bit this year, greeting people that I don't particularly care for or take moral stands against with kindness.
Great.
As I've done that, I've been able to see the fine line between letting that in and keeping it out when you need to. Like, for example, I mean, like Abraham going out to greet these people as opposed to letting them in because mm-hmm. you don't know if they have weapons or not, and it's like it's a safety procedure. It's like, I'm going to help you how I can and also keep myself safe, because if I'm not being kept safe, how am I supposed to help you?
That's a good point.
That kind of still meeting with kindness and recognizing your own limits at the same time. And I feel like this practice can definitely help figure those two things out. Like, I'm definitely letting all this pain in, and I need this, and this to be the most successful and safe and healthy person.
Yes. That's a really, really good point. And recently, with some other students in the community, we were talking about this period that we're in, which is the three-week period, right? 17th of Tammuz to Tisha B'Av. It's particular for the practice of letting pain in, because it's a mourning period and we're reflecting on these tragedies and so on. So someone said something similar to what you were saying, like, wait a minute, this is the spiritual practice, I'm supposed to make myself feel bad? And it is a very subtle thing. It's a fine line, and it's a subtle thing to say that we are greeting pain, that we are welcoming it, but that doesn't mean we're holding on to it or aggravating it. In the inner sense, you gave an example of like an actual person that you're going to go out of your house, maybe feed them out there. You don't know who they are. You're not going to bring them in your house. But it's the same kind of thing. It's like when disturbing experience arises, it's on the level, it's on the feeling level, and it's on the thought level. Thoughts emerge in the mind. Feelings emerge in response, or the other way around. A feeling emerges and then thoughts follow. A stimulus from the outside, something we see, comes in, and so on. We have a certain experience. But we have the ability to not resist what is, but that doesn't mean that we are reinforcing it or grabbing onto it. There's another Hebrew letter, which we're not going to get into in this little class, but it gives a good image for this, which is the letter Chet. And Chet has the kavanah, or the meaning of it, and again, all of these letters are different ways of entering into presence. The Chet way is to be aware of hovering. It's like your awareness is in a state of hovering over whatever is present. Hovering means that, and the image is like an eagle hovering over its eaglets. Because if the eagle would come down on top of the eaglets, it would be too heavy. It would hurt the eaglets. But if it would just fly away, then it can't give food to the eaglets. So it has to be right in that in-between space of hovering. I'm with you, but I'm not crushing you. I'm not grabbing onto you. I'm not manipulating you. And I'm not running away from you either. That's that another way of expressing this kind of...
The hummingbird.
Hummingbird, it's great. Yeah, yeah.
Quieter.
Yeah. Okay. So, let's dive into it a little more intensely now. This is something, of course, we can always be practicing to some degree. Let's intensify it now by bringing awareness into the body, into connection with our senses, with our physical form, with our breathing. B'chol yom avarchecha. And you can see the words on the on that text sheet if you want to look at the words, unless you know them already. B'chol yom avarchecha. Every day I will bless you. Ve'ahalala, and I will praise Shimcha, your name, Leolam Va'ed. And letting the words be an expression, an affirmation of awareness, resting in the bayit. Awareness has this quality of sovereignty, of being Rosh, meaning that it's not deceived. It's not taken in any way. It's simply present. into your heart. Bringing the visualization of the letter Aleph in your chest. The Kavanah of offering your awareness with generosity, with good-heartedness, with openness and willingness to be with this moment as it is and as it happens, with whatever arises, knowing that all phenomena are different forms of one reality that we call the divine, and that the awareness itself is also the awareness of the divine, the awareness of reality, seeing and hearing through our bodies, perceiving space around us, through us. Divine meeting divine in this locus of this body-mind. And offering awareness with the word lecha, long out-breath, or lach in the feminine. Nice deep breath in. Lecha. Heart, bringing left hand to your belly. Feeling awareness down into the organs, saturating all of your life systems with the light of consciousness. Feeling awareness down through your legs to your feet and toes. Feeling awareness up from the belly, back into the heart and lungs, upper back, shoulders and neck, releasing excess tension, flowing down through your arms, connecting back to your hands and fingers, back into your chest and belly, so that the whole torso and all of your limbs are saturated with the light of presence. Feeling awareness radiating upward into your face, filling your skull, saturating your brain, your spine with light. Bringing little smile to your lips to express this generosity of presence. Resting awareness on the flow of your breathing, breathing naturally but consciously, so that your whole body becomes a mikdash, a mishkan, a vessel for the divine light that you are, this awareness. See if you can bring to mind the visualization of the letter Bet as your body. So the top of the Bet would be your head and neck. The bottom of the Bet are your legs. You don't have to be the exact shape of a Bet, but just bringing to mind that you are like a Bet. And just as the Bet is open in front, so too there's a flow between the consciousness in your body and the consciousness all around your body in a vast and open field without border. Aleph in the chest and Bet as the form of your body, affirming this body connection with Na'aseh. Deep breath in. Na'aseh. left hand on your belly, bringing right hand up to your forehead, lightly touching the forehead. And visualizing this Aleph in your chest, radiating outward from your body, creating a vast Aleph beyond the body around you, shining infinitely outward, the larger oneness of all that is, and bringing to mind that your awareness of the space around you, your awareness of the space within, is only one awareness, only one space, and everything that arises in your awareness is also awareness. And you are this open field without boundary or border, free and present and alive. Venishma, deep breath in. Venishma. Kissing your fingers, relaxing your hands, letting go of the visualizations, but still keeping presence in the body and openness of space, openness to what arises, open-hearted, generous offering of awareness on the altar of this moment. Atahu or Atiyahu. Chant to continue vibrating in your mind. You're welcome to be in any physical position that works for you, but generally speaking, it's much more conducive to meditation to have your spine relatively straight, tends to be good to feel your feet on the ground and whatever's good for you, that's great. And so when you notice thoughts arising, which is very natural, just recognizing that, allowing the thought to be there, not resisting it, but also just gently and firmly removing your mental energy of in the thought and just allowing that same energy to flow down into your body, to rest in the flow of your breathing, and bring the thinking mind back to the simple repetition of the prayer, Atahu, Atyahu, you are the divine, you meaning the fullness of this, of what is. So we'll sit like this in silence, have a little 10-minute silence sit.
Thank you.
Bringing right hand to your heart, once again offering awareness with generosity, with love, willingness to be with. Chanting Lecha, deep breath in. Lecha. Hand down to your belly, awareness flowing downward through your organs, down into your legs and feet and toes, flowing back upward, shoulders and neck, down through your arms, hands and fingers, into your face, feeling into your skull, your brain, bringing smile to your lips, full presence with the body and the flow of your breathing. Na'ase, deep breath in. Na'ase. And bringing right hand to lightly touch the forehead, aware of the space around you, knowing that the space you perceive is not separate from the awareness that you are, vast and borderless open space of consciousness. Vinishma, deep breath in. Vinishma. And kissing your fingers, relaxing your hands as we go forth into the rest of this day and into tomorrow and the rest of this learning retreat, and onward from there, may we bring the openness and oneness of the Aleph, rooting awareness in the body, the Rosh in the Bayit, knowing that we are sovereign, that we can be with what is without getting seduced or fooled, but without running away either. Presence with Oseh Shalom Bimromav, Hu Yaseh Shalom Aleinu, V'Yalko Yisrael, V'Yalko Yishvei Tevel, V'Yimru, Amen. Amen. Take as long as you want, but when you're ready, you can take a little stretch.